Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It is Monday, June 29th. RIMPAC 2026, the Naval War Games got underway last week. The exercises began in 1971, are held every other year. More than 30 countries are taking part. We take a closer look at the Marines' part in the War Games. We hear from a peace activist who is moderating a webinar later this week calling for an end to the military exercises in the region. We also take a closer look at erosion on Oahu's south shore and notice of violations issued to East Honolulu property owners. And the curtain comes down on the Ward Center in Kaka'ako this week to make room for not one but two more luxury high-rises. Shoppers say goodbye to their favorite retail stores and eateries one last time. Plus, a film about an iconic big wave surfer, Buzzy Trent, is about to kick off at the Honolulu Surf Film Festival. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The military exercise RIMPAC 2026 is underway. It is the largest multinational naval exercise in the world. The war games range from sailors running drills on warships to Marines on land. And this weekend, the media was offered a chance to see Pacific nations in action at an exercise with U.S. Marines on Oahu's windward side. This year, South Korea has a deeper involvement than ever before. For the first time, a South Korean admiral will be commanding the combined naval component of the drills. South Korea is also sending its newest Aegis destroyer, a submarine, a frigate, an amphibious landing ship, and a naval patrol aircraft. And while we were scheduled to cover their participation, we did not get a chance to see their forces in action. We did, however, see Tonga, the Philippines, Sri Lanka, and Mexico.
Va a quedar su arma abastecida, ¿sí o no? Entonces, recuérdenle a su instructor o al que tienen a un costado que tienen su, que tienen un cartucho en la recámara para que lo puedan cerrojear, quitarlo y colocar el seguro, ¿vale?
Here is Marine Colonel Rob McDonald explaining the exercise.
So conducting live fire exercises with partner nations is something that the Marines do very often. We go around the world and we conduct training with partner nation forces and with allied forces on a regular basis. So we're very used to it. I think that a lot of the other countries are used to it as well. Sometimes there's obstacles to overcome, such as language barriers and those sorts of things. But I think that we've done it enough to where you come to something like RIMPAC and it's something that we can actually showcase rather than overcome any barriers and in training and in operations in the live fire event themselves. But I think that this is a showcase of how effective we can be working together for a free and open Indo-Pacific.
And the live fire practice at the shooting range on Marine Corps Base Hawaii kicked off at three sites. And later in the day at the Old Bellows Airfield Marine Training Center, the troops engaged in practice raids in an urban setting. In previous games, the structures doubled as Afghan villages. This time it was not site-specific and not live fire, but dummy rounds. But it's an intense operation nonetheless as teams take the town and gunfire is exchanged. Here's Lieutenant Colonel Colin Elliser with an overview about keeping the infantrymen sharp as battlefield technology changes. In this day and age, it's about unmanned aerial systems. Think drone technology.
As Colonel McDonald mentioned, not only is this a multilateral exercise, we are training across all warfighting functions and multiple domains. So even for me, just being in the ground combat element of this formation, as the character of war evolves, we absolutely have to look at how do we continue to maintain brilliance in the basics in infantry skills, with a lot of the training that you're seeing out here on this range complex today, but also continue to adapt new and emerging capabilities, things such as small UAS and operating in the electromagnetic spectrum, all of which are capabilities that that the Department of War and certainly the Marine Corps and our partners out here have the ability to train to.
So it's not just getting comfortable with working with drones, building and launching, but maybe shooting them down too.
You talked about drones. How deeply are the Marines getting involved in the use of drones? We watch the Army actually, you know, build them. Are you folks doing that out in the field?
Absolutely. The Marine Corps is continues to make very significant advancements in the integration of emerging technology, only one of which is small UAS or what you're referring to as drones. So what we're seeing is rapid adoption of a lot of new capabilities and really impressively, in my opinion, getting those capabilities down into the end user, really into like the Lance Corporal and the young Marines that you see training out here today that are able to rapidly innovate and experiment with those systems and provide feedback to the service. So I think a long answer but yes, we are. So the changing character of war, while it adds capabilities, there's an element of forces adapting to each other to try and gain advantage tactically. Our concept of success in the infantry is that we must continue to sustain, again, brilliance in the basics and those fundamentals of you know, really the most violent place on earth for an infantryman is kind of those last 100 yards on an objective, where all these skills you're seeing out here today are absolutely essential. There's a lot of additive capabilities that are also extremely important to be able to gain a battlefield advantage on a modern battlefield. A lot of those capabilities are kind of on display in the media and on social media. You've seen it in multiple theaters of war. But I'll just say that's something that the United States Marine Corps absolutely has a really focused prioritization on. And from the ground combat element in the infantry, we're absolutely seeking to get after that.
That was Lieutenant Colonel Colin Ellis here as we get a glimpse of some of the RIMPAC war games that got underway last week. The military exercises run through July 31st. And on that particular day that we were out in the field, we didn't see any European allies. We were told that Germany has opted not to send any vessels for RIMPAC 2026. In previous war games, Germany and Italy sent their newest and advanced warships in their fleet. And this year, we're told France has not sent a contingent as its naval ship has been diverted for another mission closer to home.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Olson Trust, envisioning a Hawaii where its people are supported by the land, and the land is taken care of by its people. OlsonTrust.com.
A judge this week handed down what amounts to life sentences for activists in Texas for, among other things, making zines and joining a book club.
The basis for the First Amendment that the Constitution writers would have been thinking of is quite literally the type of anonymous pamphleting that articulates something that is anti-authority. The Federalist Papers were effectively a zine.
On this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Beginning this evening at 7, following The Daily.
Support for HPR comes from Aloha Air Cargo, connecting Hawaii by providing inter-island shipping, with services including Aloha Next Flight Out, Aloha Standard Overnight, and Aloha Economy. AlohaAirCargo.com.
As the RIMPAC war games formally kicked off, a group of demonstrators gathered last week to protest the military operations. Former Army Colonel Anne Wright is with the group Veterans for Peace. She is to moderate a Pacific Peace Network webinar later this week. And she just returned home to Honolulu to take part in that protest. The former diplomat has made it her mission to head to hotspots around the globe. We sat down at a park bench in her neighborhood this weekend. It was a peaceful morning, a contrast to some of the places that she's been to this year. She reflected on what she has seen in her mission for peace over the last 6 months.
I just came from 2 months in the Mediterranean being with the Gaza flotillas. Prior to that, I was twice in Cuba and once in Venezuela this year. So this year so far has been a real travel year with all sorts of very important issues with U.S. foreign policy, whether it's the policies of the abduction of the president of Venezuela and now the horrific earthquake that they're dealing with, and then still the U.S. Pressure on Cuba with the threat of regime change, leadership decapitation, all of these sorts of things. And then, of course, the continuing genocide that's going on in Gaza and the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the U.S. joining with Israel to bomb Iran, and then the destruction of southern Lebanon. So all of these sorts of things have been part of what I've been trying to add my little 2 cents worth in going and seeing what's happening with my own eyes and then writing articles about it and speaking about it.
And then you have come back home. You were out at a protest to mark the start of RIMPAC, and you are also going to be leading, moderating a forum, a webinar about peace in the Pacific. So talk about that.
Indeed, yes. Well, as everybody knows, the Rim of the Pacific, RIMPAC, huge, massive naval war practice is starting in here in the Hawaiian Islands and extending out through God only knows how far it'll go out into the Pacific, but with 31 countries, let's see, I think it's 40 vessels, 200 aircraft, 25,000 people, 5 submarines, including the USS Charlotte, which was the submarine that sunk an Iranian destroyer that was coming back from military exercises with India before this war actually started with Iran. So it's important that we recognize that these exercises, which are the largest naval exercises in the world, bring in countries from all over the world, to include 9 countries from NATO. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization is sending 9 ships. 1/3 of the number of vessels we'll have here in Hawaii come from NATO countries. So the expansion of NATO into the Pacific is one of the issues that I think we in Hawaii need to recognize and to make our voices known if we think things should change.
Yeah, we did see the participation go up last year. And, you know, with the situation in Ukraine and the concern there that, you know, a lot of those countries were looking over here.
Indeed. And when you think of the number of issues that are going on in the world that are really dealing with death and destruction, and certainly the Russians and the Ukrainians dealing with death and destructions for both of those countries and the citizens of those countries. You look in the parts of Africa and Sudan where the violence there has, and they call that a genocide also, of over 2 million people that have had to move in various parts of Sudan and the starvation that's going on there. And then, of course, the continued Israeli attacks on Gaza, the ethnic cleansing in the West Bank, the destruction of southern Lebanon. So these are all very important issues that kind of come together in a way here in the largest naval exercise in the world, the RIMPAC.
And so you are going to be hosting this webinar. Talk about who all is participating.
We have participants from many of the countries of Asia and the Pacific. We have participants from Fiji, from Australia, New Zealand, Philippines, South Korea, Japan, and here in Hawaii. And they'll be talking about the issue of militarism in their countries and the militarization of the budgets of their countries as the United States continues to put pressure on all countries to develop stronger, bigger militaries. And as a part of it, buy American, buy U.S. products, buy U.S. weapons and equipment. Right now, Australia is dealing with this new issue of submarines, of buying U.S. submarines, nuclear submarines. And the U.S. already has started training Australian military on the use of these submarines. The U.S. has already sent over training people, even though the submarines are not there yet. But that's caused a great deal of furor in Australia. A lot of protests are going on there saying, we don't need these things. And we definitely don't need nuclear-powered submarines, where the world still has not figured out where to put all of this spent uranium. And as a part of that, just recently we've learned that Department of Defense has mandated itself that it has to be starting to test micro nuclear generators here in the Pacific. And even though there's not one in existence yet, but they want one, or they want two of them, to be created and then tested here in the Pacific. And nobody knows anything about how these things actually operate, how much uranium is in them. Linda Williams had a good article in Star Advertiser this last week about those, which is the first time, really, that I think most people in Hawaii have ever thought about a type of a nuclear facility. Although you can say, well, nuclear submarines come into Pearl Harbor all the time, which they do. And we're lucky that we haven't had any incidents with any sort of a nuclear fallout from any of those. But now thinking about bringing smaller nuclear generators in that have never been tested anywhere before, and this becomes the test bed again. Hawaii becomes the test bed for yet an unproven, a very, very dangerous system.
And so you'll be, I guess, starting a conversation around some of these issues. Where do you hope that it goes?
Well, we want all of these webinars that we have and all of the protests that we have out at Pearl Harbor to raise the awareness of our own community here in Hawaii and throughout the Hawaiian Islands. RIMPAC is not just here on Oahu. There will be land forces that will be going over to Poakaloa on the Big Island. There will be work that will be being done on Kauai at the Missile Defense Range. It's usually off Kauai where they sink one of the large vessels. Every year there's a sink-ex, as they call it, a sinking exercise to practice using torpedoes and other explosives to sink ships, similar to what the USS Charlotte did in torpedoing this Iranian ship earlier this year. There will be land exercises that will be going on at Bellows Beach. And, of course, we want everybody to think about all of the turtles that use Bellows Beach as a nesting area. There will be an increased number of aircraft that will be coming over our city of Honolulu. And, of course, the west coast, the Waianae coast of Oahu, has a huge number of aircraft that come through there. So there will be a lot of noise pollution and the potential for pollution. Well, not potential. There will be pollution in our waters because of these big Navy ships that even though they say we try not to pollute, they do pollute. And the amount of fuels that they'll be using there right now out at Pearl Harbor is a massive Navy refueler that will be going along on the routes of these ships to refuel them. And there's always leakage in the refueling of the ships. So this idea that this is a pollution-free military war maneuver is just not true at all. The issue of cultural sensitivity is one that, if you listen to their PR, yes, we're very culturally sensitive and we don't want to destroy anything. Well, just ask people up at Poakaloa, the lawsuits that still are going on and the environmental impact statements that have to be redone over and over because the military can never identify all of the cultural places there. And they're the only ones that can get in there because they've put so much explosive in there and they don't even know where it is. But the lack of sensitivity, continued insensitivity of using so many lands of Hawaiian heritage for military operations is something our community definitely needs to speak about.
Yeah, the leases are coming up and there's just a lot happening now geopolitically. But I don't know, did you ever think that you would be doing as much as you're doing in the name of peace at this point in your life, you know, because, you know, you've had a career in the military and with the State Department, but.
Well, when I resigned 23 years ago in 2003 in opposition to the war on Iraq, I actually didn't know one person in the U.S. peace community. My whole lifetime had been outside of the United States pretty well, and peace, even though as a diplomat, you think diplomats, oh, they're working for peace. Well, that's not always true. And certainly the U.S. military is prepares itself for war, not for peace. And it doesn't make any kudos from the Congress during peacetime. So it's always ready for war. So I really, during my government career, I didn't know anybody in the U.S. peace community. So it took a little while to get to know people. And Veterans for Peace is one of the organizations that I first found as a veteran myself. And then many other peace organizations. And here in Hawaii, we have a lot of very good peace organizations that have been working for decades to try to make our society a less militarized society. So I'm well on my way to my third decade of working for peace after 4 decades of not so much working for peace.
We've been hearing from peace activist Anne Wright talking about an upcoming Pacific Peace Network webinar set for Friday at 3 p.m. Look for links on our website later today. We have heard lots in the news recently about beach erosion on Oahu's north shore, but today we head to the south shore, Kahala to be exact. Here to talk about what's happening on a stretch of East Honolulu shoreline is Star advertiser Andrew Gomes. Good morning, Andrew.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and so what did you find out there at Kahala?
Yeah, well, a reader basically, let the newspaper know that there were some issues with not being able to traverse the beach in one section of Kahala, basically fronting Kahala Avenue. And so I went down and took a look and found out later that the State Department of Land and Natural Resources had been trying to have several, more than a half dozen property owners correct, alleged encroachments from their property into the with various things, walls, fences, even a side of a swimming pool encroaching into the public beach area.
Yeah, and historically, there has been an issue where property owners will, grow an apaka to look like, they've got more beach area than they actually have legally. And it's just a way to keep the public out.
That is for sure been an issue at various spots. In this case, for these Kahala beachfront residential properties, that is, that may have been the case in the past where, I saw historic photos with very, very lush naupaka bushes, but pretty much all that is gone. And so what's at issue now is, the ocean carving away what's left of, what used to be, the property lines of the residential properties. And, in a lot of instances, there is no vegetation between the beach and, what the border is for a residential property. And so now basically, the ocean is claiming more and more chunks of what used to be, the beachfront edge of these estates.
And your story today has some very dramatic photos of the erosion and just, chunks of concrete seawall littering the beach.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty stunning. And, I know it's in talking to people who visit the beach, it's kind of aggravating, whether they've, got to be careful where they're stepping, rubble, or not being able to, walk along the beach laterally. It does frustrate users, but this is, the power of Mother Nature at work. And it's also frustrating for I'm sure the property owners as well.
Yes. And so, what else have you been able to find out about what these homeowners then are doing? I mean, are they fixing the violations?
Some have, some owners have an easier time. Maybe it is just cutting back a little bit of naupaka. Others are facing much, much more arduous fixes. In the case, for example, of you know, one owner, basically the side of their swimming pool is, you know, is being eroded by the ocean wash. What the fix there is, DLNR wants to know, and as of most recently, they're not sure what that property owner intends to do. But on the other hand, there was one property owner that took up DLNR on a suggestion to basically reestablish part of a sand dune, a vegetated sand dune that DLNR believes would kind of keep more sand in the area and, you know, perhaps deter or stop the erosion. So that sounded that sounds promising. They haven't they're in the process of establishing that. So it sounds promising, and perhaps I'll do a follow-up story on what ends up being put there and then whether it's successful or not.
And compared to what we were seeing out on the North Shore, I mean, there you had homes collapse, really. But it's not quite as drastic as that yet on the Kahala shoreline.
Right, right. And North Shore experiences huge waves that, you know, I think contribute to the much more dire circumstances for what's happened over there. South Shore, I think it seems to be more, you know, tide related. You know, there aren't any big waves rushing up onto the shore, but still, you know, the ocean is a powerful thing.
Yes, and you know, I think too, you know, one of the pictures in the story today, you know, shows the sewer, you know, the manhole, you know, which is, mm-hmm. you know, just wild. I mean, I remember the last time that I walked down on the shoreline and a homeowner had a sprinkler system set up and there basically was no sand underneath where the irrigation pipes were. And so he turned on the water and the water was watering the ocean. It was a rather odd sight to see. But yeah, it's just eating away, you know, at our coast there.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, in this section of beach, it's you can see severed irrigation lines from what used to be, you know, the private property, just jutting out in places. And like you mentioned, there is a city manhole, you know, storm drain infrastructure that's, you know, very, very exposed on the beach as well. So it's not only residential properties, but even, you know, part of the city's infrastructure laying high and dry.
All right. Well, we'll look for a follow-up. I understand that some of those homeowners don't actually live here on island, so I'm sure that just makes it a little bit more complicated for the city. But thank you so much, Andrew.
All right. Thanks, Catherine.
We've been talking to Star Advertiser's Andrew Gomes. Look for his stories at staradvertiser.com.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at HaleakalaRanch.com.
Hey, it's Michael Barbaro, host of The Daily. The extraordinary reach of New York Times journalism brings you the sound and the story. Times reporters unpack more of what you want to know about our nation and our world as it happens. Catch The Daily Monday through Thursday evenings at 6:30 here on HPR One.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Last call for Ward Center. The shopping center is set to close tomorrow. Already businesses like Taj, Clubhouse, and Village Books and Music have moved out. Some are relocating to Ala Moana or Chinatown, while others have closed their doors for the final time. The block between Kamakee and Queen Street fronting Alamoana Boulevard will be redeveloped into two luxury-style condo towers as part of the Ward Village Master Plan. And while Ward Center currently provides 80,000 square feet of retail space, the new plans call for about a quarter of that. Our summer intern, Addis Balai, took a trip down to Ward Center recently to capture some of the memories and feelings that shoppers have. The mall has been around for more than four decades, and many spent time there to eat, shop, and connect with family and friends. Aaliyah Gabriel was shopping for mystery books at Ward. She remembers coming downtown to go shopping with her family.
Do you come to Ward Center often, or...?
I used to when they had stores that supported local businesses, but now that they've pivoted, it's been a little harder for me to even want to show up, really, because what is there to do if there's nobody to support?
Are there any businesses you used to go to or any that you're really going to miss?
I miss when the movie theater was only $7. Now it's like, what, $15 a person? I miss those. My most fondest memory of Ward Center in general was going to the theater. When we were kids, we used to collect the tickets. I still have all those tickets, you know, Transformers, Avengers, Toy Story, all those. So I think finding or going to the theater was like a weekend thing for us as a family. And ever since they started raising those prices for tickets per person and then the food as well, it's like, who can afford that with a family of five, you know? So it's really like shifted where we want to spend our time and our money if they're not really putting the people first. Why are we going to go and support that if all you're doing is raising prices to watch a movie that we can stream?
How do you feel about the fact that, you know, in place of places like Ward Center, they used to have local businesses, they're building a lot of high-rises, condominiums, things like that?
I'm not really a fan. Honestly, everybody says that it's for the people, but who do you know that owns a condominium here? I don't. You know, nobody can afford a $1 million condominium with a pool and maintenance fees. So I don't really understand why we're doing it when there was nothing wrong with the ward that we had. Sure, it was run down and needed to be renovated, but it didn't need to be tore down to be built for something that nobody's going to live in. Or it's going to be vacant for 6 months and then what are we going to do? So, yeah.
Do you have any last memories you want to share or any last goodbyes you want to say to this space?
I'm really going to miss the community that this space brought, not just for family outings, but in high school, we would come here and go get ice cream, or we would go to Jamba Juice, or we would even go to Sports Authority, you know? So it's kind of like, what's left? Even for the younger generation, like, what are they going to do? You know, that's a safe environment that they can buy things and afford for things, because Ala Moana is not... You can't afford anything at Ala Moana. You know, at least Ward, you could afford things, but now it's just one more thing that's, you know, history. So, unfortunate.
And while he didn't grow up going to Ward Center, Jake Stowe says he found his community at a popular co-working space on the second floor.
I moved to Hawaii about 4 years ago, and Box Jelly has been like one of the central communities that I have been able to be a part of. So it's been a really big part of my life.
How do you feel now that this place is going to shut down along with the rest of Ward Center?
I'm incredibly sad about it. I mean, I've been spending time in this neighborhood for 4 years, and I feel like I'll have no reason to come back here after Box Jelly isn't here anymore.
Do you have any favorite memories from any times you've come and worked here, met up with friends?
Yeah, actually, so I got married last year, and yeah, my wife and I held one of the parties for our wedding here at Box Jelly. And it was such an awesome event. We were here on a Friday night. Like, we had like 40 friends out on the lanai. We were drinking beer. It was really, really cool. Ray Chung and TK have like created such a cool environment and space here. And like, I really feel like something significant is being lost from the city with it being taken down.
Anything else you'd like to share with audiences listening at home?
I think the main thing is that not all development is good development. Especially development that takes away spaces that people enjoy being in. Like, how many more condominiums do you need?
And Kanoa Grisby is a local artist and familiar face. We caught up with him as he was manning the register at Kipuka, a workshop for Hawaiian craft and material culture.
One of my memories was there was like a dingy old parking lot that we would always park in to go to the movies at Ward, and that's gone now too, so... Yeah, lots of fun things here. I'm going to miss everything. There's not really going to be, in my mind, lots of reasons to come to this area anymore. So,
do you have any strong feelings about the new developments being put up in place of Ward Center?
I think it's, bogus. I hate it. I can honestly say that I think it's moving in a direction that I'm not stoked about. But the beach is still there. The trees are still here for now. So yeah, just gonna miss this area as it was. It's already passed, actually. It's kind of been changed and passed how I remember it and have loved it. And I feel like it's kind of gone now already. So yeah, the heartbreak has, I've had it and maybe gotten over it by now. So, but change is a part of everything.
And Shannon Seamster was volunteering for the Friends of the Library book sale that was held at Ward Center. She says she's been coming to the area since she was old enough to walk.
We used to do a lot of family dinners at Spaghetti Factory, which was my favorite. My sister and I used to play on the stage in the center court at Ward Warehouse. I remember practicing driving around and around in their parking lot, right? Because it was a super long parking lot. So we used to go and practice going over the bumps. Oh gosh, yeah. It was a college hangout. You know, we all used to meet at Ryan's in Ward Center. So yeah, I've got a lot of attachment to Ward.
Any special places that you're really gonna miss?
I think Ward Warehouse I'm already missing because it's gone. I guess just the center, the feel in general, because now all the big high-rises are coming up and it's so different. Just driving down here, it's kind of sad actually, but progress, right?
How do you feel about that progress that they're making high-rises and condominiums in place of communities like this?
I mean, I get it, but progress for progress's sake is not necessarily the way to go sometimes. Sometimes you kind of got to hold on to the old stuff, so. But I don't know. I'm sure there's a lot of people that can argue the other side. But it's just sad. You don't see a lot of the old stuff anymore. I know that I can go down the street to go to Spaghetti Factory, but it's not the same.
Well, we've been hearing from visitors to Ward Center in its final days. It closes for good tomorrow. See photos and more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training.
Aloha, this is Derek Malama. Please join me for the first episode of Kanikapila Vintage, the new podcast from HPR featuring classic interviews from Kanikapila Sunday. We're kicking off the series with the Brothers Casimero at the legendary Mountain Apple Studios from 2004. It's available this Thursday, wherever you get your podcast. Sponsored by Manu Healii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Ferraro Choi, Hawaii Architects designing scientific support facilities for the National Science Foundation across Antarctica. FerraroChoi.com.
Increments of fear. That's how waterman Buzzy Trent would measure waves, not by feet, but by fear. Trent helped develop modern big wave surfing in the 50s and 60s, making a name for him at Makaha Point. And his story hits a big screen in a new documentary titled Increments of Fear, The Buzzy Trent Story. It debuts next week at the 17th Annual Honolulu Surf Film Festival. His daughter, Anna Trent Moore, and her husband, Ronald Moore, dug through decades of footage to bring this legendary surf story to life. HPR's Kevin Allen spoke with the couple about Buzzy Trent, a larger-than-life waterman.
Big wave surfing involves a lot of fear. And so increments of fear is how you measure your courage when you're attempting to do something that is probably bigger than yourself. And so you measure it in increments of fear.
That's what it gets down to, really. You know, you throw the footage out, you're dealing with survival, fear, and everything else, and how you deal with that fear.
he was kind of among the first big wave surfers in the modern era, right? And that's such a fascinating time to me because, you know, now we have jet skis and we have inflatable vests and we have all of these safety precautions. But back then, I mean, surfboards didn't even have leashes. If you lose your board, you're swimming into the beach. It must have taken just so much courage back then to be able to paddle out into waves of that size.
You had to be a complete waterman, really, because like you said, it was very much, big wave surfing was in its infancy in the 50s, particularly the early 50s. And so many of them, I mean, if you look at the pictures from that time in the film, were very built. They were very well-rounded watermen who in the off season would train by diving. Free diving, deep diving.
They were very comfortable in the water. And I think you used the word raw. It was very raw in the beginning. These guys were inventing big wave riding. And these were the guys. You know, it was George Downing, Buzzy Trent, Wally Froiseth. All the guys were shown in the movie, of which we have the footage of because we own the Bud Brown Film Archives, which he captured during that era.
Right. It's really a legacy. The Bud Brown Film Archives actually captured a lot of history being made. I mean, how did you guys come into possession of all of this film archive footage? And can you kind of speak to Bud Brown as a person as well? Because I think he's so important in this film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Bud Brown always described himself as a man of few words. He was a very hard person to interview because he spoke very little. And I think his story is told through the surfers that he captured, and he preferred it that way. His first trip to Hawaii was in 1938 on the Mariposa maiden voyage. And since that time, he began going to Hawaii nearly every year. And he was a waterman himself who began as a diver and a swimmer. But in the 40s, he began filming surfing. And that he is a father of surf film cinema. He captured it as a hobby in the beginning, but then was the first person to make the commercial surf films, the first one in 1952, that birthed the surf film. Yeah. He was a friend of my father, Buzzy Trent. They knew each other in California before Buzzy sailed to Hawaii in a catamaran. And Bud followed him there in 1952 and captured the birth of modern big wave surfing at Makaha Point with my father, George Downing, Wally, and that tribe at the time. Bud Brown captured surfing most prolifically, perhaps more than any other filmmaker in those decades that was the infancy of big wave surfing and also the shortboard revolution. And he never married or had children. So I could say in many ways that I was Hanai to him. I was like a daughter to him.
She's like the daughter he never had. They're very close.
And he, when he passed away, he bequeathed his library to me because he knew he was very close to Buzzy. In fact, when we made this film, it was really interesting. One of the things I realized, which I should have known all this time, how much he documented his life more than any other person. I mean, from the time as a young man before he sailed to Hawaii to the early Makaha days of big wave surfing through the 60s, his personal life and his family, his working in construction, his transition into hang gliding at Makapu'u until his older age. So Buzzy carried the stories. Bud carried the stories, and there is so much of the stories within me through osmosis and through just my deep love for the people in it and my love for surfing.
Which worked out very well for us in making this movie because we had access to all the archival footage taken by Bud that related to her father that we needed for the movie, and then there are other related stories within the movie too.
That must be a monumental archive. What does that archive even look like?
No, you're talking 16 millimeter original film. And then we've had some digitized too, because there is a shelf life. Everything's in really good condition, but there is a library.
There is a library where there is much, a lot of it that has not been transferred. That's probably going to be a life work for somebody after us too. So, I mean, yeah, it's quite a prolific collection of surf history.
And Anna, you grew up with your dad, but what was it like watching the footage? I mean, did it match your perception, you know, entirely of your father. Or sometimes I'll see old pictures of my dad when he was like 20 in Mexico. And I'm like, who is this guy, you know? So, I mean, it must, what was it like for you, I guess, kind of coming into this?
Well, I've grown up with the footage. One of Bud's favorite things to do when I was a young girl and woman, you want to watch some movies? And so he would show me the films. So I've grown up, and I was always very aware that my father was a big wave surfer because we lived at Makaha Point. And I always thought that the goal of every surfer was to ride a 30-foot wave. And so it wasn't, no, I didn't see something go, wow. But I am still amazed by the footage because I look at the footage and see, that's why you have to come see the film for yourself, how well they were surfing. I mean, how well Waimea was being surfed, how well Big Makaha Point was being surfed.
On balsa wood surfboards, on wood surfboards, because foam didn't come into play till around 1959, 60, at the end of that decade. So they're all doing this on wooden surfboards.
And all of them were had amazing presence. Buzzy did have a special presence about him. And I knew growing up that my father was a little different than my friends in elementary school, because if you've seen Buzzy's physique, he looked different.
It's like Hercules.
He looked like an action hero.
So he really epitomized a big wave surfer. This guy's gnarly. Okay. He's going to ride a big wave.
But, you know, that I look up to him as this extraordinary person. Of course, as a child, you always see your parents as your parents. Yeah. But I knew very early on that my father came from a faraway place in California, from a very different life. And he chose to sail to Hawaii and spend his entire surfing life and raise his family in Makaha. And I knew that he was different than a lot of my friends' fathers. Just he looked different, and also that he was extremely driven and waited for big surf. My father gave up everything to be at Makaha, to wait for Makaha Point to break, and nothing made him happier and more excited and more loquacious and animated than that. And I saw that in my father, and that was something that I grew up with and knew was a deep passion that not everybody has. But like I said, Buzzy was also part of a tribe, and I was very aware that the group of friends, which were very close, all had extraordinary presence, all had passion, all had drive, and their main focus was finding the biggest way that they could. One of Buzzy's favorite books was Death in the Afternoon, because he loved bullfighting. And, you know, had they not been surfers and they lived in Spain, they probably would have gone on to be bullfighters. They just had that personality, that persona that was driven to have a focus to be larger than life.
And that's something I think maybe mystified a lot of people. Your dad is such a big presence in life that there are like literal myths and legends about your father. Like I feel like you know, there's a lot of big wave surfers who, you know, they like have these tales of Buzzy Tran, like, oh yeah, he did that or he did this. And it makes him sound like a superhero or like a Greek god. But like one thing I've heard before and I've always been curious about is why he, you know, stopped surfing. And I think like the popularized story is that, well, he pulled back on a wave and he knew if I'm not going to go on this wave, I'm going to just stop now. Is that real, or why? What brought him to stop?
Yeah, that's in the film, and
we can't tell you.
He actually talks about that. Buzzy was one of those type of people that when you left, you left. When you go, and never look back.
Clean exit.
Yes, he was a guy of the clean exit. And interestingly, he left surfing looking like that action hero, still in top form, and he left surfing on a big winter day. For him, he said, I wanted to have good memories of what I gave myself to and not the day that it drove me to the shoulder.
Yeah.
And that's just the kind of person that he was.
He wanted to go out on top.
Yeah.
And then he saw, you know, he was 45 when he stopped, which isn't tremendously young for big wave riding. You know, he had this vision. In the movie, he has an analogy about these boxers, Joe Louis, that stayed in the ring too long. And they got punched drunk, got beat up, and it was ugly toward the end. He said, I did not want to become that. So his clean exit, like Anna said, he realized that right now, I don't want to be the guy pulling back, being on the shoulder. I want to go out on the top.
He wasn't, his whole trip was riding big waves. He would not have transitioned well into just surfing for fun on small waves. Buzzy Trent, he didn't even surf in the small wave season. He only surfed in the winter. And when he wasn't surfing big waves, he was diving. He loved free diving. He loved diving for fish. He would practice for the big winters by going into fish holes to hold his breath for as long as he could. His whole focus was riding big waves. And it takes, he knew that at some point, you're going to be holding back. You're going to be being driven to the shoulder. And he says, I admit, I have an ego. He did not want to have that day come. Mm-hmm. So he decided, he went surfing with George one winter day, and he said, this is it. This is the last wave I ride. And he
held to it.
He held to it. And interestingly, he didn't like town. He loved Makaha. He gave everything to be in Makaha. And as soon as he quit surfing, he got rid of his board and he moved to town immediately and never went back to Makaha, never even looked back at it, never once, never returned.
Wow. We've been hearing from filmmakers Anna Trent Moore and Ronald Moore talking with HPR's Kevin Allen about their new documentary, Increments of Fear, The Buzzy Trent Story. The film will open the Honolulu Surf Film Festival on July 9th. A talk story panel will follow the premiere featuring surf luminaries like Clark Abbey, James Jones, and Jock Sutherland. Head to our website for more details. That's it for us today. Tomorrow, we'll hear more about a project to boost civic engagement among our youth. As we celebrate the 4th of July and our 250th anniversary later this year, what are your thoughts about the founding of our country? Call our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Did you know you can find the conversation as a podcast? Head to our website or search for it on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.